Greetings to all listeners. I'm Lavanya, and today we have with us Dr. Akhtar Badsha, who is an expert on social impact, philanthropy, CSR, and international development, and is also an author and artist. He's a founder and chief catalyst of Catalytic Innovators Group, a new consulting practice focused on accelerating social impact through catalytic innovation. Formerly, he was also the senior director of Microsoft Citizenship and Public Affairs, where he administered the company's global community investment and employee programs. He is also currently a professor at University of Washington School of Business and Ivan School of Public Policy and Governance. He is also a faculty lead at START Center of the Department of Public Health. Join with us as we ask Mr. Badsha some interesting questions and know his response to them. So, Mr. Badsha, here is my first question. When I was reading about you, I found out that you're an architect who hails from India. How is it the journey from India to starting your career as a lecturer at MIT and then venturing into various other domains and then becoming a philanthropist? So, like, could you briefly talk me through various decision-making processes that happened at every juncture at different stages of your life?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, some of these decisions are just kind of very simple, right? I mean, I studied architecture in India, graduated from the School of Architecture and Planning in Ahmedabad, one of the premier institutions. As you know, most students who graduated that time, you have two choices. You go into architectural practice or you try and apply for a master's degree somewhere. And in my case, I applied at MIT, which is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the US, in Cambridge. And it was my only application that I did, and I got admission. But as you know, having come from India, you know, getting an admission is just one part of the process. You then also need funding, and then you need to get a visa. And in my case, I managed to get funding as a scholarship with partial scholarships, and I got a visa. So I came to the US to study. And while, like you are doing, I also had to work at the university to pay for my tuition and some of the scholarships that I got. And I happened to, you know, work at a new program that was getting launched at that time called the Aga Khan Program for Islamic Architecture. I mean, I was really doing mostly just, you know, there wasn't really any intellectual work I was doing there, right? I mean, I was just there to help out, to help faculty members. And the dean was there, and the dean then asked me to do some additional work, which led me to become part of the faculty where a new program was being launched called Design for Islamic Societies, which is what I then did because it gave me an opportunity to teach at a very young age. I got a PhD, and then an opportunity came about where I was asked by colleagues at the UN, where they were starting a new nonprofit focused on mega cities, to see if I was interested in working for that and joining that effort, which is what I did, right? So these were just kind of opportunities that came. My wife at that time, you know, finished her computer science work from MIT, got work at Microsoft. She moved to New York. So that was a good opportunity for me to join this firm, this organization. And then she moved to Seattle. So I picked up and came to Seattle, where I got other opportunities to work in another nonprofit, which was starting off, called Digital Partners, where in 1999, we were at the forefront of focusing on bridging the digital divide, which then got me to Microsoft to run their philanthropy program, which I did for a decade, and then I joined the University of Washington to teach. So it's just these opportunities that come, which if you are astute enough to recognize these opportunities, you will grab it and not just get stuck with one particular line of work that you may have qualifications to do. And in doing so, I have expanded my horizon and gained, you know, multi-level experiences, which I would have never gained had I just remained in one specific field.
This is great. The first thing that came to my mind when I was reading your works and going through what you've done is you've worked in various domains. I don't know, like, if all of us have the courage to shift domains so quickly and do well at all of them. I think it needs a lot of courage to make that decision to shift your domain.
Yeah, either it's courage or it's foolishness, right? That you actually don't understand the gravity of the situation. So, I mean, you know, I could have been at MIT, I would have been a tenured faculty member, I would have done well, I would have been in, and that would have been fine too. I mean, it would have been fine too. It's not that you have to move careers. In my case, that's what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. Very inspiring. Like, for someone like me, I don't know, I want to venture into a lot of other things. So that got me thinking, how do I make that step towards what I want to do? Which is, I think it needs a lot of courage, and you've done it so well, which is very inspiring.
So just for your listeners and for you, it wasn't that I kind of made any conscious decisions, right? I didn't start off by going to MIT. When I went to MIT, my goal was to become an architect and practice architecture. That's not what happened. I didn't seek out to be a nonprofit leader or a philanthropist. These just happened. So in some ways, I did have a destination in terms of what I wanted to do. What I wanted to do, I didn't do, which is becoming a practicing architect.
But it's also about foreseeing the opportunities in the other domains as well, right?
Correct. Yeah.
I think it worked out for you, and it's great. And now that we get to read your books, it's wonderful. My second question is, you started your firm as the Bacha Consultancy as early as in 1996, followed by the Digital Partners in 2004. What were the challenges technically, financially, bureaucratically, given that you shifted from India to a foreign land? Any challenges that you faced which could help young entrepreneurs be wary of their decisions or their options?
In my case, I had no choice. I mean, when I started this, because my wife moved from New York to Seattle, so I had to leave my job and come here, and I had to figure out what else to do in a new location. So till I figured something out, I just, you know, said, okay, I'll consult. And I started, you know, Bacha Consulting to consult. And till the opportunity at Digital Partners came along, which was basically a very fledgling organization, which, you know, I was basically just asked to go help. And then I suddenly had to run it from 2000 to 2004. And when I was doing that, that's how I got connected to Microsoft. And that's when, in 2004, Microsoft asked me to run their philanthropy team. So I mean, you know, the general lesson is, start doing things. Stop worrying about creating an organization, which is part of the thing what I talk about in my book, that it's not about creating organizations. It's actually serving where you think you can best serve. So one of the things that I kind of get people to stop focusing on is not what you want to be, but who you want to serve. Who do you want to serve? And you can serve in very different capacities in different areas. So if you kind of create that mindset around service, which is what gets you to that purpose mindset, right? That it is all about service. And it's not one thing that you're doing. You can serve in multiple different ways. So even though I teach today, I speak on a completely different subject, which is my book. I consult. I've started another nonprofit because of COVID. And these are just opportunistic. So there isn't a way where you get stuck in just doing one thing. But that's what you should be comfortable in doing. Not everybody is comfortable in doing that. I like new challenges. Or at least now I think I like new challenges. Right? So I gravitate towards that. But for some people, they can just be happy in what they're doing as long as they can find purpose and meaning in the work that they're doing. And that's really what the book is trying to tell you.
I have a follow-up question to this later about purpose and approaching it from my age, but then I'll come to that later. But a little more about how you took it forward, and then now you head the Catalytic Innovators Group, and then how different is this from your journey before, and have the previous experiences helped in this?
Yes, of course. I mean, it has, right? So when I left Microsoft, I felt that, look, at that point when I left, I felt that I had done enough. Well, I could share what I have learned in three different ways. So I created my organization, Catalytic Innovators Group, to do three things. One, consult with organizations and individuals around effective philanthropy and how do you effectively give back. Create a space where I can convene people around different issues that were important to the community and community development, and teach, where I could transfer my knowledge and insights to students. Of course, what has happened is that I'm spending 100% of my time teaching, and then 30% of my time consulting, and 30% of my time convening. Right? So I run a executive leadership program called Accelerating Social Transformation that happens in October. It's online now. We get people from all over the world join for a period of 4 weeks. It used to be in the summer, in person for 4.5 days. Think of it as an intensive program that kind of just takes you through this approach around how do you discover your purpose and how do you amplify the work that you're doing. And that's what I kind of set out to do by saying that, I'll do 30%, 30%, 30%. But that's not the way the world works, right? Things happen. And then you have to be flexible enough to be able to say, yeah, okay, I mean, there's a lot more people want me to teach and talk about different things. So you do that. And then obviously you want to consult and you want to convene. So you find ways to do it. And that's what I do now. And it kind of comes about because I've built the relationships. I've been in multiple fields where I was in senior positions in these multiple fields, which I carry those relationships with me. In architecture, in the non-profit space, in the corporate space. So they are all in some ways important.
The 30%, 30%, 30%, I can relate to because, as a student, you end up doing like, I don't know, 4 to 5 jobs, and then you think that it's 30%, 30%, 30%, but I understand that it can never be that. So my next question is, which you've partly answered, how did your path as an architect lead you to the position of a head of philanthropy in Microsoft? Was it only because that your wife moved and she was working at Microsoft, or was there a more serious reason as to why you chose Microsoft and the philanthropic work in particular? Before you answer, I very clearly remember you speaking about the Bhuj earthquake in Gujarat and how it all started for you, which I felt I could connect to very well during this pandemic, because back at home everyone's not doing well, and then sense of purpose also begins somewhere when there is adversity, you could say.
Yes, so clearly, I mean, we are seeing that happen, right? That what is happening in India today, and you're seeing the community just outpouring of support in terms of trying to get oxygen respirators or medicines or other things. We have also started here with my nonprofit a whole effort around India. But your question was, how did I get to Microsoft and philanthropy, right? So what I was doing with digital partners was essentially focusing on how technology can get into the hands of the poor and that we could bridge that gap. What we recognized at that time was that it was not just the financial gap, but an intellectual gap. That information technology was going to create a much bigger gap of people who have access to knowledge and those that don't have access to knowledge. And our nonprofit was really focused on bridging that. Now, coming to Seattle, you cannot but not meet people from Microsoft. I mean, it's a small town, it's a big company. And so when you're running a nonprofit, you're trying to raise money, you're obviously interacting with people who are in this company. And we were doing work. And that work then led to more connections to Microsoft. And then when Microsoft was looking for its new leader to run the philanthropy team, they asked me if I was interested in that job. And having people on my board who were former senior executives of Microsoft and others, it made sense for me to move and take on this role. Right? So I kind of moved from a discipline that was more focused on getting money to a space of giving away money. Now, the reason Microsoft hired me that I had in that time running that nonprofit built a tremendous relationship globally with nonprofit organizations. And for Microsoft, that's what they were looking for because they didn't have connections to nonprofits and they wanted a leader who had that understanding and that viewpoint. So I brought in the perspective of the community into how philanthropy gets done. And that's what allowed me to kind of create innovative programs. So yes, my wife was instrumental. I mean, if my wife had moved to Seattle, there was no chance I would have this role, right? I would have been in New York and I would be doing other things. And the Butte earthquake happened at the time when we had just started this organization, Digital Partners. And I felt that I had a responsibility to mobilize the Indian community to give and contribute. And so many of them working at Microsoft, it became a place where you could actually engage Microsoft employees to contribute. So that's how Microsoft leadership also came into touch with me. So these are just circumstances, right?
Circumstances, yes, definitely. I cannot help but relate to many things that you've written to the current situation and how it's prevailing, how it's becoming very, very relevant now with the pandemic and people looking out for deeper meaning to what they are doing. I think it holds a lot of relevance at this point in time, especially. Yeah, so my next question is quite different because when I was reading one of your blogs, I think I came across this article on art is the livelihood of the community. And then there's a quote that I really liked, which said that for technology and technologists to thrive, they must develop the other side of the brain. And many of our employees believe that as well. So, as an artist myself, I totally agree with this. But as artists, at some point in time, you have to draw a line and say, this is my passion, and but this is my career. Not always these two go hand in hand. So what would your suggestions to young artists be at this point, who might not do arts as their everyday career, but they're venturing into different domains like engineers, doctors? How do you draw that line and say this is passion and this is profession?
I think that there is really no, I mean, I think that's why I kind of really don't want to distinguish between profession and passion. You are who you are. You have to bring your whole self to everything that you do. I'm an artist. The painting is mine behind me. I'm an author, I write. If I move my chair, you will see an outline of a canvas sitting here. I have my paints are right behind me. I have a canvas, so I work on a canvas. The power of an architect is that you have to use both sides of your brain, the right side and the left side. Architecture as a profession actually forces you to use both sides of your brain. You can't just draw pretty pictures. You have to put together a building that needs to stand and cannot fall, which means you have to understand engineering and structure and load-bearing walls and all of those things. So as an architect, you do both. And in most cases, we are shoved into one or the other. And the point of writing this is that we have a full brain. Use it. And an artist doesn't mean that you just paint. An artist means you might actually enjoy singing. Bring that into your work. You might enjoy music. You might enjoy opera. You might enjoy theater. You might enjoy writing. But if you bring all of that to your work, to everything that you do, then you are much more satisfied with what you are doing. Because now you're present in your full self and not just saying, okay, this is has to be done in the evening and this has to be done in the morning and this has to be done during my work. No, bring it all together.
I understand when you say that for architecture, but what about someone who is doing a desk job of 9 to 5 and then it's just exhausted?
Right, so let me ask you, yeah, so take your coffee barista. Their basic job is to serve you coffee. Someone do it with great pride and joy and purpose. They make it an art. And the next person just serves you coffee. I point you and say, there is a mug, go take it. So it's how you show up. If you have a desk job, fine. You have a desk job. But who are you? And how do you make that desk job relevant? That to me is purpose mindset. That infuse your work with yourself. And then the work will thrive and you will thrive.
I understand. But I think we've deviated a tad bit from the topic of saying how as artists we can survive the desk job. That was my core of the question.
You can, right? No, so you can, as an artist, also survive your desk job because you can bring art into your work. Right? So, say, so you might actually say, I'll paint differently, not during my work. But your approach as a visualizer, you can bring into your work. And when people see that in your work, you are actually able to conceptualize things visually, people will gravitate to you and say, do that more. Not everybody, you know, everybody works differently. So you can use your visualization skills even in work by creating charts, by creating diagrams, by creating ways in which, you know, when somebody talks and drawing it out into a concept. And now people say, hey, this is a great skill. And for all you know, you might actually become that. in the company, because somebody might recognize it. So that's what I'm saying, right? That the mind has no boundaries. We put boundaries on ourselves that, you know, I'm an artist, so I've got to just do canvas. Great, if you're a potter, go take clay and sit in your office and do something with it that is relevant to your work. You know how to use your hands now, right? So you can actually model things for people. Right? So as an artist, you are bringing a different, you put on a different lens. And what I'm saying is that same lens can also be put into your work and not just when you're drawing a line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. Looking at it from a different perspective. Yeah, I think I can manage that. Yeah, so my next question is about the 30-30-30 time management that you were talking. Essentially, it does not happen that way, right? So how do you manage your tasks in general? Is there a principle that you follow as to prioritizing tasks as such?
I mean, I think that, you know, not really. I mean, you know, I know I get these, and people want, I mean, they all want these answers and saying, you know, I have a list and I've got these software and I kind of keep track of time and, you know. No, there are days when I fall behind and then there are days I do. But what does happen by taking on way too much is my days start very long. I mean, my days are long. My work time is very long. I mean, I start out early in the morning and I end late. But then you're going to say, okay, that's what I want to do. Nobody's really forcing me to do this.
So you're against the list making and the using software?
Not necessarily. No, I'm not against anything. I'm just saying that different people have different ways of how they do things. For some people, list making works great because that's how they are made up of. That's not my strengths. My strengths are being able to juggle multiple things at the same time in this very chaotic way in my head. And I'm a great example of chaos theory. That within that chaos, I find meaning and apply it. And things then start, you know, making sense. But for some, it might become absolutely crazy to do that. Some people like things to be extremely orderly. But the point again that I make in the book is discover your strengths. Work from your strengths. Apply that. Don't fix a problem. Work with your strengths, apply that. And then you will be happy. Because that's what you enjoy doing. That's why you thrive. And all I'm trying to get people is discover yourself and then have faith in it.
Yeah, it's true that I fall into the orderly category, so I like to jot down. So, yeah, I cannot think of a chaotic this thing. Yeah, it's totally dependent on the people.
But that's fine. But again, now if you look at it from a team perspective, right? Now you can actually get these multiple people with multiple strengths into a group. That group will thrive. Because I might come up with lots of ideas. You might actually be very orderly and then say, okay, here is what we're going to focus on. And then everybody will kind of get down to that. Then somebody else will say, these are my strengths. I'll go run with it. So, but if you got me to sit down and take notes, I'll be horrible at taking notes. I'll write all sorts of nonsense there. And then if they ask you to go do, you know, 15 things at the same time, you will not enjoy it either. So that's what I mean, right? So when you want to kind of work in teams, discover your strengths and then figure out how you can work with each other, utilizing that. Now you get a much better output. And so that's what I do. I then surround myself with people who are more task-oriented, will keep manage things, keep me on track. I tell me not to do something. And then that works.
I think as a whole, then the system works really, really well then. This is my last question. It's about your book and what you've said in the book about purpose and your seminar as well. It was very insightful, and I'm yet to finish your book though. I bought it on Amazon. And then for all our listeners, I think you can buy it on Amazon or Kindle. And I would really recommend reading this book because it made me think differently. My question about purpose is, I feel people look at purpose differently when they are at different stages in their lives. For someone young and just a university graduate, I would say everyone's running the rat race. So it's just about making money or feeding their family or living a better life. I don't know, sometimes it's also very nihilistic. So what would be your thoughts to this group, age group in particular, as to how they can realize purpose better?
So first of all, I actually find that the younger generation is much more focused on purpose. Right, so where have we come from? We've come from this whole attitude around growth and growth mindset, which Carol Dweck wrote, in the 1990s. And her basic thing was, don't have a fixed mindset, have a growth mindset. You should be a continuous learner. You should continuously improve. You should fail fast, move forward. And what that has done is that focus has been on yourself. I grow, which then leads to growth in the work that I do, and then I grow again. And you've actually created this duality. What I'm asking is to get off that and create a trinity. Why do you want to grow? Why do you want your work to grow? It has to do for the betterment of society. And if you can introduce that element in it, then you get the trinity. You grow, work grows, community grows, you grow, community grows, work grows. Whichever way you want that trinity to function. So purpose is really about recognizing within yourself, right? So it's not saying, okay, go do something different. It is all about how you do what you're doing. So the five principles I highlight is, one, discover your strengths and work from your strengths. In whatever you're doing, figure out what you're good at. And then bring that to your work. That will make you much more happier. It will actually make your work happier and it will have more impact. Second, put on a lens of abundance and not scarcity. There are always resources. Just start. Third, it is not about doing things the right way. It is doing the right things. It is not about efficiency. It is about effectiveness. Keep that in mind. Fourth, it is not about creating organizations anymore. It is about creating movements. It is actually changing minds. It is bringing everybody else along. It is no longer this top-down approach. And then fifth, it is about empathy and compassion. You have to move from the focus on the we, on the me to the we. It is all about the collective good. So purpose is that ability for you to heal. It gives you that replenishment of energy. And it is really that light within you. Just turn it on. Everybody has a light in them. You have the power to turn it on. But if you wait for somebody else to tell you to do something, then it's a very different ball game. So for young people, you will make that change. Go out and do it. Don't wait for somebody. Look at what Greta Thunberg has done. She didn't wait for anybody. She decided that this was important to her, so she sat in front of the, Stockholm, the parliament every Friday to protest. And that turned into a movement, a global movement. Malala Yousafzai did not, wait for somebody to come and give her a platform. She spoke out against being stopped from going to school. Got shot in the process. Young people have done this throughout history. People in their 20s and 30s have been the change makers. They've been change makers in societal change. They've been change makers in business also. All of these products and companies that you use are people that have been very young who started it. But if you apply a purpose mindset to what you're doing, you are actually then doing it not just for your self-growth, but for the betterment of the world. And that's really what I want people to absorb. And what I show in my book through profiling individuals, I show how they have come at different stages in life around purpose. And applied their growth and purpose mindset and combined them to bring about societal change. And I'd love for your readers to come and join my website and my community, at purpose-mindset.org. Share with me how each of you are making change. In your own ways, small ways, big ways. How are you thriving? And now you can create a community that is looking at the world in a very positive way. And that's really what purpose mindset is all about.
I think all of them will get a greater insight through your book and your seminars. Because I've heard of the five principles that you spoke about in the webinar as well, which I took some time to post-process it. So it was really nice to sit back later and then again review what you've said. So thank you again for doing this session. Before we end this, I just have one more question. Are you writing any other book, or are you coming up with some interesting articles that we can read?
I'm not writing another book right now. I'm in the process of trying to get this book out and talk about it. There's some other articles that will come out, but this is about some of the work that we've been doing around COVID and vaccine hesitancy and mask adoption, which will come out in the summer. Some of the work that I've been doing with my students, which again, it also reflects on how a group of individuals just came together because they were driven by purpose and for the last 1 year, we've been doing work around the world with some of the approaches that we discovered.
We'll wait for it, and then we'll definitely follow what you're writing, and we'll tell our community about what a wonderful person that you are and the wonderful work that you're doing. And your book will speak volumes for you and everything that you're doing. Thank you, Dr. Bhatia, for doing this wonderful interview with us. I'm sure the listeners have had a wonderful insight into the person that you are and the work that you do. To you listeners, if you have liked this episode of the podcast, then let us know your thoughts and comments below. See you all in the next podcast. Thank you.